Good evening. Welcome to the Salieri Report. Today is August 8th, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I'm speaking to you tonight from Connecticut. I came up to New York last weekend to record Eunice Boston and her team for next week's Salieri Report. Then I headed up to Newport, Rhode Island for 2 days of meetings and incredible weather. I'm on a swing through Connecticut. Everywhere I go, restaurants and stores are packed. Along the northeastern seashore, the summer season is in full swing. The sailboats are filling the waters of the Atlantic, and the petunias are gloriously in full blossom. This weekend, I head inland back to Tennessee. Our theme tonight is pension funds in play. You've been watching a tremendous back and forth over state and local pension funds. It really got going as the bailouts began, but it's really beginning to get serious now. It's sort of the chance for the state and local pension funds and the various people who serve them to take their turn in the doghouse. There are lots of angles on it. Part of it is the best defense is a good offense. If you look at the people who engineered the financial coup d'etat, they have a lot of reason to feel defensive vis-a-vis the state and local pension funds, who with their purchases of mortgage securities and treasury securities have certainly suffered a great deal of debasement and financed a lot of shenanigans as interest rates have dropped. And yet, if you know, it's really the pot calling the kettle black. The people who led the financial coup d'etat, the leadership really wants to see a lot more privatization, and they want to break the back of the unions, including the state and local unions. It'll be a lot easier to do privatization if state and local officials are on the defensive, particularly about their retirement benefits. And it's going to make it easier to go forward with various outsourcing and equity vehicles. We saw a proposal this week from Orrin Hatch. The link is up on the blog, basically proposing that the way to save, quote unquote, save the state and local pension funds is to engineer annuities. It's not unlike the annuity plans proposed on 401ks that really got shot down a couple years ago. One of my theories is that if I'm right and there is an expectation of engineering big rises in the equity values, this will pretty much lock in the sort of obligations of the state and local pension funds. So the annuity proposal basically locks in the benefits at the current values. And so if we do see a big increase in equity values from sort of re-engineering North America, the insurance companies will get the benefit. It's the same problem as healthcare. We're loading up on intermediaries, just as I've always said about Obamacare. Americans don't need more healthcare insurance. They need healthcare. Actually, they need health. So, but loading up with more intermediaries is not going to help. To me, this is sort of the targeting of the state and local pension funds. Oh, and let me just mention a great list of the lies about state and local pension funds, which were prepared by some Salieri Report subscribers who are very knowledgeable on this topic, is now up at the top of the blog. And if you're interested in the subject, I really encourage you to take a look at it. The bottom line is, if you're a beneficiary in state and local pension funds, I'd be inclined to trust your administrators a lot more than the people who are doing the criticizing at the federal level. The hit on the pension funds to me is part of what I consider to be now the message rolling out from the kind of consensus that probably happened at the Bohemian Grove at the end of July. We're watching the boom being lowered. And I go back to this framework that I keep talking about, and we talked about in the interview with Dr. Farrell. If you haven't listened to it, we've got the transcript up now. It's really excellent. I would encourage you to do it. But we literally have seen the legacy economy during the financial coup d'etat. Approximately, my guess, $40 trillion moved out of the old economy. The liabilities left in the old economy, we've watched, including with the Fed quantitative easing, the fraudulent paper bought up and pulled in both by the Treasury and the central bank. The trail has gone cold. That $40 trillion is now across and safe. We see the sort of article up on the blog, Financial Cleaner Cometh, hitman going to the IRS that's part of the cleanup of really making sure that that trail goes cold. So this money is now across, and you're watching the leadership turn to the legacy systems, and now that the money is pulled out and is very difficult to go back and claw back, what you're seeing is, in the old system, the bringing of financial accountability. So now that we've stolen all your money, we're here to lower the boom and demand financial accountability. And so you're really seeing on multiple fronts this lowering of the boom. And part of that is of course, the retirement benefits, and state and local government is one of the places. Now, there is pushback. Great decision, a very interesting case up on the blog, ruling against Sun Capital brought by union pension funds. It's one of the examples of a private buyout firm going in, taking over a company, re-engineering it, pulling money out. Then the company goes bankrupt. The pension funds left high and dry, not unlike the game that Bain Capital, Mitt Romney's firm, played. And a court ruling that the private equity firm is liable for the pension funds. If the it's a very interesting case because it's also one that unfortunately could be used in the wrong way against a reasonable private equity effort. And it's just another example of how the criminals mess it up for everybody. Okay, money and markets. Let's look at some more issues of lowering the boom. A big one is, now that the pump and dump of the housing market is over, we have the administration, not surprisingly, as we've talked about many times in the Solera report, announcing that they're going to have mortgage finance reform. And what are they going to do? They're going to withdraw the federal credit and taper Freddie and Fannie slowly out of business. The theory, the headline, of course, saying this is going to speed housing recovery. No, it's not. It's going to make it much easier. It's going to shift capital out of the mortgage markets, out of the residential mortgage markets, and much more into the corporate markets. And so this is going to, again, advantage large corporations renting apartments vis-a-vis homeowners buying their own. We've seen over the last 50 or 60 years enormous growth in investment in housing in this country, and it's really a result of three things. One is the mortgage interest deduction. Another is the incredible supply of government guarantees through the FHA, through Freddie and Fannie, through the VA, through the FDIC, through the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, through multiple sources into housing, and then finally inflation. And the combination of those three things have been very much part of building a much higher per square footage per person in America. So houses getting bigger and bigger. If you pull the mortgage credit, and we'll see what happens with the mortgage interest rate deduction, I think it's clearly on the table to get shaved back as part of the deficit reductions. But as you withdraw that, of course, then you unpump the housing market. Given that we have big corporations picking up big inventories planning on doing rentals, it's gonna close the spread between what's attractive, home ownership versus rental. So this is another example of just the financial accountability coming back in, the boom being lowered. We continue to see enormous amounts in investigations and prosecutions at the local level. And one subscriber this week said the message is, if the big boys can do it, but you can't. I also think part of the message is civil money penalties and making sure that the local guys don't cut themselves in for a big share. Part of this hit on state and local governments is in anticipation of place-based equity. And what I mean by that is beginning to finance big urban areas with vehicles that focus just on that area. So as I said last week, Nashville, a group in Nashville announced the creation of an exchange-traded fund that's just investing in companies in Nashville. My expectation is we could also see REITs or venture funds just focused on that place, and it's all part of what I call the trading places theme. One of the keys to that happening is much more literacy about the financial and environmental ecosystems within a place, and looking at places looking at the place-based data in very dynamic ways, which of course the software tools have been allowing us to do now for about two decades. But that really hasn't come out from behind the one-way mirror, we see a very interesting video that I put up on the blog, and I encourage you to watch called Capacity, which is using those tools to describe and discuss what kind of capacity can we handle in downtown Los Angeles. And I, you know, little tools like that to me are another symptom or another sign that we are beginning to move towards this notion of trading places. Of course, in the emerging markets, we've seen the explosion of exchange traded funds that let you invest in a place. So, and of course, the big urban areas in Asia, particularly Singapore and Hong Kong, but that hasn't come to the United States. There was a group that tried it out in the West. I think Oklahoma, Texas didn't catch on. So let's see if it does catch on. Probably the most important news we saw this week, and it's a story that I continue to be very careful about, and that's the news from Fukushima of the continued inability to contain the radioactivity. It continues to pour into the ocean, radioactive water, and impact on the land around. We have one question this week from a subscriber about Fukushima. Let me just read it. We are greatly looking forward to your broadcast this night, this evening. We have a question not directly related to the topic. We would like to understand truly what is going on with the Fukushima nuclear situation. We are in Hawaii. Are Hawaii, the west coast of the United States, and other parts of the U.S. being exposed to radiation? What about the oceans and fish? We continue to read about sustained and even elevated levels of contamination being released in the sea and air. A couple of sites that have daily news are, and there are two that are posted. You can see it on their post on the blog, both of which appear to be grounded and legitimate. Should we be concerned about our children and future grandchildren's health if we remain living on the west coast of the U.S.? Thank you so much. I continue to spend 3 months a year, approximately, on the West Coast in the San Francisco area. So this is something I try and look at. One of the reasons that I have never given a firm opinion on this question is that there are very legitimate and reliable sources in our network that take very opposing views on the safety issues here. Some saying that things are very dire, including for the West Coast of the United States. Others saying that's not true at all. It's being exaggerated. We did, when we had James Corbett on the Solari Report, we discussed this because he has a website that just covers it. And I think Corbett is a very reliable source of news on this topic. But there are others. And so I continue to believe that this is a very, very important story. And trying to figure out what is happening is something that is, of course, of great importance to me. And I will continue to focus and try and understand, but I do not know the answer. I had breakfast this morning with a very marvelous subscriber. We talked a lot about the fact that the European Union countries continue to move towards détente and in more intensified relationships with both China and Russia and the BRICS. Putin is very masterful in how he's playing this. Of course, we see the president cancel his summit with Putin over the Snowden affair. But Putin tends to be, or continues to be, very, very clever at playing at the heart of the Anglo-American alliance's problem, which is they really don't, particularly after the financial coup d'etat, they're really struggling to find their mandate of heaven, and but relying more and more on force. And so I continue to wonder exactly how this is going to play out, and I don't underestimate the sort of the danger in the on the geopolitical scene of this loss of mandate of heaven in the Europe moving closer to the BRICS and the Asian countries. The Edward Snowden story continues to still percolate with more revelations coming. As I said last week, great story from The Guardian on the fate of the internet and the balkanization of the internet. And if you haven't read it, I really encourage you to do so, because there are now tremendous issues of sovereignty, both of countries and companies, and greater distrust of the cloud. We posted every week. We have two or three roundup meetings on the Soleri team, and we've started to just quick post little commentaries as we do a roundup. We talk about what the most important events of the week are and the important events of the day. And then inspired by that, we sort of come up with a little commentary. And one of the things I wrote was one called War Has Many Faces. What I discovered chatting with our team this week is, and last week, is that the progression of warfare from a military war where armies land on somebody else's turf and there's blood and guts and battles, those kinds of wars still happen, but more so war has evolved into the financial world and markets. It was always there, but it's become more intense. And now we're watching that war, of course, spill over into the digital systems, which is what the Snowden story is about. And so we literally see war move out of the physical realm alone into every aspect of life. And so warfare becomes ubiquitous and intimate. And it's an evolution that kind of started at the end of the Cold War and the development of the digital systems. And now it's really interrupting the integrity of the marketplace and the integrity of the digital systems. And of course, the result of that is that a breakdown in trust, and nothing is more deflationary for an economy than a breakdown in trust. And so this is a very important story because we're now all struggling, whether it's our digital systems or our financial systems or our food system, we're all struggling with issues of integrity and who can we trust, more and more happening informally and through networks of trust. On the FedWatch beat, we have two resignations. Not surprisingly, when the chairman's resignation or when the chairman's term is up and you expect to see turnover at the chairman level, it's not surprising to see other turnover. We have the president of the Cleveland Fed announcing her retirement in 2014. Elizabeth Duke, a governor at the national level, at the federal level, announcing her resignation. Two women leaving. It's almost as though you'd expect Summers was coming in. Summers, of course, got terrible complaints from the women at Harvard when he was there. But I don't expect that to be the reason. I think Yellen is the favorite and will probably end up as the new chairman. So we may just have the first female chairman of the Fed is what I'm expecting. But turnover happening. Very interesting development. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos buys the Washington Post. Actually, the paper is a small piece of the Washington Post corporate entity. Bezos is paying about $250 million to a company that has about a $5 billion market cap. My personal experience with the Washington Post is simply dreadful. My feeling is that I won't bore you with a whole story this time. I've told it before on the Soleri Report. But my personal experience is that it's a paper or a news media of little integrity. What it ran, how it ran, what it buried was all part of playing dirtball politics. So whatever he is, Bezos is a refreshing addition. As Amazon continues to grow and tries to really take over the cloud, it is certainly a very inexpensive way for Bezos to watch his back in the DC lobbying swamp. So I think for him, a very clever and intelligent purchase, and it will be very interesting to see somebody who's very masterful with online systems, what they'll manage to do with the Washington Post. But it shows you how the technology is moving. Precious metals is still looking for a bottom. We haven't found it yet. Stocks about the future is still the dazzling part of the market, with Tesla Motors being today's darling. You know, everybody takes turns being the darling and then being in the doghouse. But Tesla Motors is now up over 400% for the year to date. The world keeps waiting for the U.S. stock market to enjoy summer correction, but it hasn't happened yet. But just about every other asset class is in the doghouse. Bill Gross, after pummeling the bond markets with his comments in the last 2 months, experienced tremendous outflows in his funds, biggest bond fund. He runs the biggest bond fund in the world. And so he decided to finally make some defenses of the bond market this week just goes to show you, how his pendulum can swing. Anyway, that'll be the big sort of, everybody's still holding their breath to see what happens with interest rates as well. So let's see what we see coming into the fall. Our hero and our interview and our movie this week is Marcin Jakubowski, who is the founder of Open Source Ecology. And I can't recommend it enough. One of the reasons I had Marcin's speech in 2011 at TED, why I made it our movie this week, is I wanted to make sure that you watched it. It's only 8 minutes long. It's a great quick introduction to what he's doing. Marcin was a physicist who decided that, that nuclear physics and the kind of physics he studied didn't really have a whole lot of practical applications. He looked around and wanted to make a serious contribution to the world, became a small farmer in rural Missouri, and quickly realized that the economics of small farming, among other things, is you're on a treadmill to buy and make the kind of equipment you need to run a farm. And so he developed a vision, understanding open source technologies as he does. He's also a technologist. He decided to do something called the Global Village Construction Set, which is 50 open source blueprints for the tools, the machines and tools that you need to ensure the success of small farms and communities. It's a very brilliant idea, and I think one that's very important. I think with something like the Global Village Construction Set, particularly if it migrates to things like 3D printers, will be able, a community or a farmer or a co-op of farmers will be able to radically reduce the cost of making and managing and maintaining an inventory of the tools and machines they need to really be highly productive. I know Marcin's goal is to really develop the basis by which a community can work 2 hours a day and then enjoy life for the rest, which to me is a very beautiful vision. If you look at place-based economics and the kind of economics we need to migrate through the change we're going on, such a set of open source blueprints, particularly if they were prototyped and developed by a wide network, which is Marcin's vision, is a I think could be absolutely wonderful for the human race and in throughout the globe. This is something that could be tremendously useful where I live and tremendously useful in millions of communities around the world. There are many different ways that we each can plug in. Marcin has a group called True Fans. I'm one of them. And a true fan is somebody who donates $10 to $100 a month for 24 months. You can go to his website, become a true fan. They also do online design sprints. So if you have technical expertise to contribute to the building of the blueprints, you can jump on online with Marcin every week or every 2 weeks and participate. It's very interesting. I've done one so far. And then finally, they have local sprints where people come and work on building and designing equipment. The two pieces or the two machines they've gone the furthest with are up to Tractor 6.0 and the brick press is far along too. But there are many different opportunities to plug in both virtually as well as locally or as a donor or just an interested party. So take a look at it. I think it's one of the most inspiring efforts going on, and it's just the kind of thing we need to really make a difference. And again, if you look at what's happening with the maker movement and with 3D printing and other kinds of fabrication technology, I think there is this is an area of explosive, both explosive economic productivity, but explosive cultural excitement. And there's going to be a lot of great community growing up around these efforts. So check it out. Check out the TED speech and check out the interview was very interesting. We did the interview and got to talking and couldn't stop. So we ended the interview, and then I gave Marcin a little background on my designing of the certain kinds of transactions back in Washington at Hamilton Securities, and then a briefing on the MIT project management system, which I had used at Hamilton Securities, or I use whenever I do a big complex transaction. And he asked me to record it so that he could let his staff hear it. And we have also posted those interviews up on the blog as well. So that's if you're interested in project management systems or the design, you know, open and online, because on the virtual designs, on the design books we did at Hamilton, we would have as many as 200 people coming in online from all sorts of different places. And, you know, so it was a very interesting project management situation. Okay, ask Catherine. Catherine, you said that you believe that food will be replacing oil as the asset backing for the U.S. dollar, and Dr. Farrell suggested that the dollar will be backed by data control. I think that you are both correct. Like in the book of Revelation from the Bible, you shall not buy, sell, or trade. It is as if Mr. Global is taking over the basic needs of each human being on the planet, as described in Maslow's hierarchy. They want control of all our needs to control. We are their human resources. Please comment. The idea of food replacing oil as the asset that is controlled, or the trade is controlled, which therefore backs the U.S. dollar, is where I think the Anglo-American alliance has been going, which is why this effort by Putin to checkmate the GMO movement, and Europe to checkmate the GMO movement, is so critical, because that's not just about the quality or nature of the food supply. It's also about who controls the reserve currency. And it's also about who's the breadbasket for the world, because Russia is also competing to be breadbasket of the world. So I think that is where the Anglo-American alliance has been going. I agree with Dr. Farrell that data control is essential to that whole effort, as well as the management of the financial system. We have an unbelievably centralized and levered financial system, and so data control is essential. I'm always quoting Nicholas Negroponte when he was head of the MIT Media Lab, when he said, in a digital age, data about money is worth more than money. And I couldn't agree more. So yes, data control is very important. Do I think that there's an effort to control people? Absolutely. That's a lot of what we talk about on the Solari Report, and I make no bones about it. The single most profitable enterprise in the history of the planet is slavery. And so harvesting people financially is, you know, simply the next generation. A question about pension funds in the IRS, which I'm going to see if I can't throw to an expert. Then I listened with interest to your first and second interview with Dr. Farrell on the breakaway civilization. In the second interview, a comment was made on the assassination of JFK, as though today people are able to accept that this was a conspiracy and coup d'etat. Oliver Stone made it seem so clear. What about the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the Twin Tower and Pentagon? Have you seen the documentary film 9/11 Mysteries? If not, you can watch it online. Would you be willing to discuss the factual content? Then lots of questions about 9/11, including the fall of the towers. I wrote a great deal about 9/11 right after 9/11. So I think I had the first big story up on the internet on Narco News. It went up right after 9/11. It was called Cui Bono, and it basically was a polite way of saying the official story is full of yaya. I did a lot. I was one of the founders of Unanswered Questions, which is a wonderful website early in the day, and I think did a lot to holding open the sort of collection of research that made it possible to for the architects and engineers to finally gather and do the incredible work that they've done on 9/11. I think it's fair to, if you want to go back, go to the article section in on our website to see all the different things we've written or I've written on 9/11, including a letter to Condoleezza Rice that got me, when she was National Security Council, that got me into all sorts of trouble with the powers that be. I will say, based on their reaction, was a very effective letter. Anyway, the long and the short of it is, I'm clearly on record that the official story is complete hooey. Having said that, exactly what the truth is, you know, who knows? Clearly, the fall of the building was not the result of the airplanes hitting it. It was something else, and you know what it was, I don't know. And I think without the powers of government to prove evidence, it's very difficult to say. But there are lots of theories about what it is, and clearly the official story is hooey. From the same person, I first listened to your observations and perspectives when you were interviewed by Bonnie Faulkner on Guns and Butter, Part 1, 2, and 3. Will there be a Part 4? We have no plans to have a Part 4, but you know, who knows? Then a great comment from a subscriber. Hello, Catherine. Maybe this will put some light on what's going on in the Dallas-Fort Worth and the surrounding area. I quote from you, somebody's building out a major infrastructure. There is a group partnership of private, public, and academic organizations called Vision North Texas. They have put together a very bold and impressive plan that engulfs the 16-county North Texas region. The plan is called North Texas 2050 and can be found on their site. Some of the names of the sponsors will jump right out at you. The game plan North Texas 2050 hides no bones that this 16-county area will be self-sustained and contained. At their 2013 conference, the speaker was Dr. Richard Jackson from UCLA. The theme was designing healthy communities. Then there's a link to visionnorthtexas.org. Maybe, Catherine, you might be able to get someone from this organization on your program. This particular undertaking in North Texas brings to light the flow of capital back and separate systems at work, bringing in the new and leaving the old behind. I hesitate to say this, but I believe it needs to be pointed out. If the map of the simulated reserve and corridor system to protect biodiversity is to be believed and ends up accurately portraying the population geography of the U.S. sometime later in the century, then inside North Texas 2050 will be one of the few places where us humans will be living. Times are definitely changing. Anyway, I will take a look. Another question. Since receiving Social Security checks over 10 years ago, my husband learned that the Social Security Administration recently ran a credit check on him. Can you tell me what purpose or need the Social Security Administration would have to run a credit check? I have no idea, but that's a very interesting question. I'm going to circulate it and see if I can find the answer. Another from a wonderful subscriber. Hello, fellow Solarius subscribers. This is off topic, but I hope someone looking can help me. I'm moving from Minneapolis to Portland, Oregon, and I'm looking for a place close in. It's a tight market, and I'm having a hard time finding a place. You can read the rest of it and get Beth's email address up on the comment section at the Solaria Report. I've sent her an email saying, have you checked out Airbnb? Lots of interesting things I find in places like Portland and Airbnb. Okay, that's it for this week. So in closing, let me just say, coming up, we've got some very interesting Solaria reports. On August 15th, Coming Clean, Transforming Lives Through the Power of Cleaning with Eunice Boston. I'm going to introduce you to a lovely team of people, Eunice and two of her colleagues, who run one of the most, it's sort of cleaning for the rich and famous. Eunice has done many celebrities and many very important institutions in New York, and she is a remarkable person. Her company, for many decades, did all of my cleaning. She has moved me. She has catered me. She has cleaned and run facilities. But most importantly, she is an incredibly powerful, spiritually powerful woman. And when I tell you the story of her participation in the events of Hamilton Securities, Eunice Boston and the power of her cleaning saved my life. And that's a true story. And we'll tell it on the Solaria Report. August 22nd, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson will be back, former chief of staff to Colin Powell, very distinguished military career, now teaches national security. Strategic issues facing the U.S. military, warfare in the 21st century. If there's any organization that has is managing an unbelievably complicated, challenging situation, it's the U.S. military, as the finances of this country get ever more dependent on the military. And so I've been looking for a year for someone to really cover all the different issues facing the military. And after going back and forth on these with Colonel Wilkerson, I wrote back and said, you know, there's nobody better. You have to come back. So he'll be back. And then next month, first one coming up in September, we're going to start on crowdfunding. The change in regulations is expected this fall. Crowdfunding is something which I think is not only going to rock the world of everybody listening to this phone call. I think it's going to rock the equity markets globally. That may not mean it'll do it this year, but it's certainly going to get going this year. And it's something, because of the profound impact it's going to have on many people and many lives and on the markets, I think it's something we all need to know about. So we're going to start talking about it in early September. So until next week, August 15th, with Transforming Lives Through the Power of Cleaning with Eunice Boston. Until then, ladies and gentlemen, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck. Okay, well, it's my pleasure to introduce today Marcin Jakubowski, who, let me do that again. It's my pleasure today to introduce to you Marcin Jakubowski, who is both physicist and farmer and the executive director of Open Source Ecology, which he founded in the final year of getting his PhD in physics at the University of Wisconsin. He's joining us today from his farm in Missouri, where he's building something we're going to talk about called the Global Village Construction Set, and he's doing it with a team that is both local and global, on-site and online. I can't think of a more important project to building the kind of decentralized economy that we talk about here on the Solari report. This is something, and we'll talk about it later, which is a very important option for the investment of your time and donations. And I'm very excited that Marcin could join us today. Marcin, welcome.
I am glad to be here, Mackay.
Well, tell us how you went from being physicist to farmer and inventing the Global Village Construction Set.
Yeah, the standard answer is, so maybe backing up a little bit, I always thought about the power of science creating good things for humankind, and moving further in the educational system, I felt more and more disillusioned about where I was going. And basically in the second year of the PhD program, I was studying fusion. Got quite disillusioned with it. I came into it thinking, oh yeah, fusion is a great energy source for all humankind. And then it kind of became clear that, well, there's issues with it. I mean, there is radioactivity. And it always seemed to be 10 years into the future. So it was kind of disillusioning to see these sessions and back at the university, just theoretical presentations I went to. It's like, I was just starting to ask, well, how is this relevant? How are we really addressing pressing world issues when there are so many of them? And I felt we were just getting farther and farther removed from that. There was a trigger point. Well, I mean, trigger point, perhaps, I mean, just to give you an example of what I'm talking about here. It's one time I went to a professor to ask about, this is something I didn't understand about this wave propagation, some equation that stretched across half the board. So I asked him, said, well, where does this apply? Can I see this thing? Is that some wave traveling through space here? And he said, well, oh, it actually doesn't exist. I just made it up. So, all right. Well, so that's kind of one of those hits where I started thinking about other ways of, well, started thinking about other options. Yeah.
Well, it's where, so, you know, it's funny, you see
that time, so it's through that long, even though I was disillusioned, I actually ended up finishing, and it was a long 5-year walk to freedom there, where I was out a couple of times, but finished it.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing I did was start up Open Source Ecology. Basically, uh-huh. I would do a lot of time studying sustainability, economics, social justice issues, and Madison is kind of a radicalizing place, so that definitely influenced me. I got in highly involved in the student community and all kinds of organizing,
uh-huh,
new groups. And then the last was open source ecology. And the way that evolved was going from various organizing and a social scene, then getting more into the sustainability forums, then getting into one group that I started called Gandhi Network, where we actually got some hands-on practical experience, such as building a bicycle power assist or a solar food refrigerator. But then at the end of the day, I kind of felt disillusioned with that too, because we all get into that on a weekend, and us, the weekend warriors, and then Monday, the person goes back to work for the man. So that wasn't so satisfactory. And at that point, I thought, well, okay, if we're going to do this, we're going to have to jump in deep, create deep, lasting solutions where people can check into an alternate reality.
Mm-hmm. So is that when you moved to Missouri?
So the first year right after that, we settled on 5 acres of land in Madison. Basically, I knocked on some farmers' doors, and land is abundant. People actually get tax write-offs for doing agriculture. So we did that and learned about weeds and equipment. Yeah.
Yeah. It's and how did you choose Missouri?
It happened that some of the organizing friends in the nonprofit sector, they had land down here, so we just settled on that.
Okay,
great weather, not a lot of codes, cheap land.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep, I know all about it. Of course, I live in Hickory Valley, Tennessee, and it's the same thing here. I was talking to a friend in San Francisco the other day, and I said, you know, to own my house next to you would cost $10 million. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so tell us what the Global Village Construction Set is and how it came to be.
Yeah, Global Village Set, that's a set of the 50 different industrial machines that it takes to build a small civilization with modern comforts. We talk about things to provide food, energy, fabrication, things, everything from a tractor to an oven to a circuit maker. There's industrial robots, renewable energy equipment. It's a set of tools. Basically, coming up with that meant, what are some of the things that a person needs in order to be able to create a sustainable civilization or sustainable community or sustainable household? And the Global Village Construction Set was more dedicated towards the village scale or the city scale, starting the infrastructures that are necessary to do that. And it's a set. The concept, people always ask me, well, why do you have this machine instead of that one? Why don't you have the biodiesel reactor in there? Or, well, I say, oh, okay, well, we're making a choice based on the complete set being sufficient to provide a modern standard of living.
Right.
And we won't know that until we test the entire thing. So I'm sure there's many other options and iterations we can do, but for right now, let's just get the thing done and see if it works. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you come into Open Source Ecology, into the website,
yeah,
how do you find the Global Village Construction Set, and what is in it now?
Right, so you can go to opensourceecology.org, and if you click on GVCS, that will list all the 50 different machines.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you go to our wiki, you will see a lot of a lot of development pages. The four machines that are closest to release, we released the so-called Civilization Starter Kit version 0.01 with a tractor, the brick press, soil pulverizer, and power unit, where you can download that from the front page and build all of these machines yourself if you have the skills. The plans are all open. We encourage, our name of the game is replication and adoption. One more thing about just to briefly mention about what the GVCS is. It's a big, hairy, audacious goal. The claim here is that a few people can take this entire set. Well, actually, on the application of a community scale, like say 200 people, you can take this set, and I'm actually claiming that as few as 12 people with the set can create an absolute modern standard of living, minus semiconductors, at 2 hours of work per day using local resources.
And when you say 2 hours a day, how long do they have to be doing it?
Sorry?
How many years?
This is if we have the entire set complete.
Uh-huh.
You can build it out in 6 months.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Radical efficiencies of production, and we have the theme of one day pervasive now, kind of branding it around this concept. But we built, for example, the brick press last December 18. We built that thing in a single day. So we're pushing the limits of effective open source collaborative production, where by module-based design, basically we break the machines down into the simplest modules possible so that many people can work to design them and build them in parallel. And then towards the end, if you're building this thing out, all the people work on the individual modules. And if the interface is designed, the way that these things fit together is clearly defined, then you can just assemble them together in the last hour. But that's right. The kind of model, just really pushing the efficiencies of production, because the technology know-how is there. It's simply the access to these enabling tools, to the knowledge, really.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's the key.
And I think the confidence to know that you can make things.
Absolutely. The thing is, I've been transformed myself doing this to see that, wow, we have some amazing potential underneath us in our own hands, and I'd like to show that to many other people on this planet.
One of the things, when I first read the story of what had happened to you and became aware of the Global Village construction set, I'm very, you know, in my experience, what the farmers always tell you is the thing that puts them on the treadmill is buying the tractor, paying the loan on the tractor, and then of course that the tractor means they need gas. and the, you know, they're really on an equipment treadmill. And I saw the story of you starting this with when your tractor broke down, right?
Yep.
Right. And so it was March and saying, I want to get off the tractor treadmill. And you see farmers who certainly over where I live, the farmers spend in inordinate amount of time learning how to fix their own equipment. And if you look at how much time they spend trying to fix their equipment or dealing with broken equipment, what you realize is, you know, if they just built it to begin with and did it, you know, sort of as a, in a simpler streamlined form, they'd probably save time. And so I looked at this and I said, this is, you know, this is going to work. This is absolutely going to work. Yeah.
Yeah. So right now, if you hear any of this grinding in the background here, we're on a fifth day of building the tractor, the version 5 now.
Uh-huh.
And our goal is to show that, I mean, right now, actually, the goal was to do it in a single day, but...
Really?
That, oh, yes. Our goal is to build each one of these machines in a single day by radically optimizing the production methods, breaking down the things into modules, and... These days we're holding, actually I want to invite people in the audience, if you go to opensourceecology.org/wiki, that's our wiki,
mm-hmm.
you just search for design sprints. What we hold every weekend is sessions where we collaboratively develop all these different machines. So we basically sit around Google Docs, SketchUp, and other online tools to do rapid development on these.
Now, a design sprint is online or on-site or both?
It's both, actually. The people on-site, we may have like 6 people on-site, but it's dedicated to the remote audiences where, I mean, imagine the setting here where, imagine 100 of the world's best engineers come together to do this. You're talking about some serious progress that not even large corporations have access to, and we have the advantage of the social mission that we carry that is the glue for all these people. So
right.
We have, we're tapping an innovative, well, that's just the open source method. We're tapping the human, well, basically the people who are interested in social good beyond what they're doing. So say an older person who's done something professionally
right.
for their life and now they're contributing back to society. This is a venue where this can be expressed.
So tell us, let's go back to, you created the Global Village Constructions. Let's go back and talk about mm-hmm. how you've organized people coming and helping and supporting.
Yeah.
So you started out because your tractor and your farm had run you out of money. You started with crowdfunding, correct?
That's right. So basically when we started, it was myself and my partner that settled on this 30 acres of raw land in Missouri, first thing we do is build a little house, start a little bit of agriculture, then your tractors break down. Yeah, and when that happened, I was broke and started crowdfunding. I basically reported on a blog what I wanted to do, started setting up funding baskets, and people paid for it because I was committed to it. This was my life.
Uh-huh.
I was showing progress. And that was, yeah, a long time ago.
When did you create 1,000 true fans?
We don't have 1,000 true fans. We have about 400 right now.
I know, because I'm one of them.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm a true fan.
So this is where, so this goes into our explosive growth, because since...
One of my goals is to get you 1,000 true fans. I want you to get up to 1,000.
Okay, that's great. So let me just tell you a little background on that. So in 2011, we were operating on a 2,000 per month budget, and I was putting all my money into the development.
Mm-hmm.
We got put on a world stage with a TED Talk, and it's been growing 500% ever since.
Fantastic.
But, the true fans numbers grew and so forth. But in the last year, lots of growing pains as you scale an organization.
Sure, absolutely.
I kind of lost track with the true fans, so that if you sign up as a true fan, that's my bad that I don't even know about it, because we're just reorganizing all those databases and all that. But we're actually just setting up a True Fans network where I'm going to basically, every 2 weeks, there will be a conference call with me. We can discuss things. And I want to get the True Fans involved in the design sprints much more, because there's a lot of different areas that people can contribute in. But, yeah, we want to get those numbers up. And especially we want to diversify our funding sources, because right now we're largely supported by foundations. And that comes and goes.
Right.
So we want to go back to our crowdfunding routes and production. So right now, the brick press, tractor, maybe the CNC torch table, they're all very close to being viable products. I mean, we did actually clear $25,000 back in 2011 selling our equipment. So we've got proof of concept. But as we move forward, in order to scale this to the level of replication of all these OSE incubators worldwide, we need to do that by bootstrap earnings.
Is it good economics for you to start a school? Because I know a lot of farmers who are going to be hesitant to just take the, you know, download the plans and do it themselves. They're going to want human contact.
Right.
And and so an opportunity to come to Missouri and, you know, just do a workshop with you.
Yep.
You know, and it could also be online, but I think they're going to need personal contact. So.
Right. So I'm glad you bring this up, because we are talking a lot about that right now. So for one, we're creating a two-week crash program for developing all these skills and technical skills, but also organizational skills.
Right.
We're pairing up, and this is just very recent. The tractor we're building right now is going down to our school at Blair Grocery, an urban farming project in New Orleans. And they're actually a school. So the education part, that's something we are starting right now, but the thrust right now is to finish the 50 GVCS tools by the end of 2015. So
we'll
develop our techniques in 2014-15, go into rapid development, and at which phase we turn pretty much the focus shifts to education. And that is where we take individuals to become the OSE fellows, to go an immersion training crash course for 2 years. It's like university, except you get practical skills. And in the last 6 months, with our assistance and collaboration, we would build out a new facility elsewhere, and then you would run it. That's the general concept.
Well, ideally, you can find a way to organize the education so you are paid to regularly, you know, draw in everything that's being learned by the use and prototyping, and, you know, keep evolving both the set and the education.
Absolutely.
So it's a cycle.
Yeah, and so maybe we can talk more deeply about this, because this is, I think it's actually a great revenue model where we put all the proceeds back into fueling further development. An excellent way. One way we thought about it right now is the production runs, the single-day production runs, are an amazing transformative experience.
Uh-huh.
So we could have people coming in, actually paying us, and then the machine itself goes to some kind of a pilot project. So there's revenue streams in multiple locations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's real funny. I sat down in 2008. I read the new housing bill that Congress passed, and I called my attorney, and I said, I'm right next to the farm, which is an, or I'm friendly with the farm. It's I'm not right next to it. It's a couple hours away in Tennessee. And they give home building courses, and I always thought, oh, that's too hard. And I read the 2008 housing bill, and I called my attorney. I said, you know, and her son at the time was 16 years old. I said, it is much easier for your son to learn how to build his own house than to have to deal with this system anymore. And yeah. I think those kind of sprints would be very exciting for many people. Okay, well,
let me actually add to that, because there's one experience right now that we are offering, and that is on September 28th, we are going to do a build of the OSE micro house where we show the use of the tractor and the brick press, and we build a 400-square-foot structure. Now the foundation is going to be prepared. We're going to build a 400-square-foot structure in one day.
Oh, fabulous.
24 people. We can have a lot more people doing documentation and other things. We're going to charge people for that. Other people get to come for free. This is actually part of our Kickstarter reward structure. We still owe people this natural building workshop. But actually, this will be coming out. Follow us at opensourceecology.org. You can follow the blog. But that's going to be published actually this week. September 28th is, and we actually have a world-class, world-leader architect, landscape designer, John Motlock from Ball State University. They are collaborating with us to put forward the design and do the construction management. This is really exciting.
And if somebody wants to sign up for that, how do they do it?
Email me, marcin@opensourceecology.org.
Okay, great.
marcin@opensourceecology.org. So we're going to have probably 10 to 20 people from our side. We can open it up to about 10 to 20 more.
Okay. And you're going to be building it with brick?
We're going to be building it with brick.
Brick, okay.
And we're going to press 5,000 bricks in a day.
Ooh. there's a wonderful Sidney Poitier movie about pressing bricks. I don't know if you've ever seen it. But
oh, no.
It's my, that was my introduction to brick pressing. Okay, and it's going to be at the farm in Missouri.
Yes, it's in the Kansas City area of Missouri.
Okay, perfect. Okay, now just you have to tell me, how many nationalities do you think you're working with around the world, both online and people coming to Missouri to do this with you?
The global community is naturally global. There's been 12 replications around the world and I believe 4 or 5 countries. Actually, last month the bricks started rolling off a press that was built in China.
Really?
So, Yeah. And it's a person who actually came here as a dedicated project visitor. That's a way we can have people involved on site. They were actually organizing that project and that. So it's interesting to see here and there. It's like, whoa, hey, that's my machine. And we encourage that. We're not afraid of that. We want these good tools to come out there because they'll have to compete with us. It's an open market. So we're actually reinventing the open market here.
Has there been any connection between you and the woofers?
Yeah, we've had woofers here. There's been a few people on. Right now we're looking for a full-time farm manager as well. Our priority right now is to get a production manager to actually produce the machines, also a farm manager. So we're trying to work that into the budget. I think the production manager would be self-supporting by the model of production and education. And
this is why I think it's
economics.
Very important to grow the 1,000 true fans up to 1,000 because it would give you the steady inflow you need to build the management infrastructure.
That would be great.
I'm the queen of business models.
Okay, we need to talk because what I've learned, one of the main lessons, if you ask me what I learned personally, it's like there's a difference between vision and execution, isn't there?
Although I will say this, that my generation was not trained in project management where you really break things down to a granular level unless you're an engineer or you had certain kinds of, you know, particular training. Whereas I find your generation is, because of they've grown up with the software tools, is much better at complex project management and collaboration. So I'm hoping that that has made a difference.
Yeah. Oh, I'm seeing just immense potential coming from that. The breakdown. There's the software model called, I forget the name, but there's a model like that where basically in software, forget the name of that that thing, where they have demonstrated already that if you take a complex software program, you can actually divide it into tiny parts and give it out as little chunks to many people, and that ends
right.
up costing you much less.
And well, my company in Washington was, I discovered, when I worked in the Bush administration, I discovered sort of the internet and software tools, and the web was just starting. And so I went to the software industry to get the project management tools we needed to, because I was trying to reinvent sort of the capital formation process for what the new tools would allow. And the software world has those. We use something called the MIT Project Management System, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm.
Is it open source?
I believe so, but what I'll do, anytime you want to, I'll give you a little mini course in the MIT Project Management software.
That's one thing we're really trying to get up here, is we just got our operations manager in place. We need to install it. We're not really doing much for project management right now. So we need
if you have time after the interview, I'd be delighted, or give me a time and I'll let you know.
Okay.
But it's okay, so one of the things I realized looking at the construction set was there are, when you build something and you want to just make it available open source, you think, oh, well, this is really easy, I'll just make it open source. And then you discover, no, I have unbelievable global issues in terms of the law related to how I protect this from somebody else copywriting it. And basically reverse engineering it out of open source. How have you grappled with the legal issues of protecting the intellectual capital for the commons?
So for one, we're installing a contributor agreement where people agree that OSC becomes the owner of this intellectual property in order to keep it open forever. So people give their rights up to us as the protectors of the IP. Now, the good news is that anything that you publish openly, like even on a wiki, you can not get a patent of it because it becomes prior art. Now, the thing that does happen is that improvements can and do get patented.
Right.
But typically, so what's the solution for that? Well, we have a viral clause in our IP policy, which says that if you use our materials, then you have to contribute them back into the open.
Right.
Any improvements into the open. So
that's
how it works. So far, we didn't have any problems, but not like we've got any extraordinary IP right now. But the thing is, there's a question of sufficiency that I actually believe in quite strongly. It's like, okay, we built this brick press. Well, you can put all kinds of bells and whistles on it, but a 10 brick per minute brick press is as good as you need. You don't need any more for most purposes unless you're really insane. So so there's a sufficiency aspect. It's like we only need so much to thrive,
and
beyond that, it's extras. So,
right.
so there's that element that a lot of people are forgetting. Now, I do believe that innovation occurs constantly and things will get better and better, but there is also the sufficiency aspect.
Right.
Yeah.
It's one of the dynamics you look, I'm an investment advisor, so I work with individual families, and one of the things you see is their entire balance sheet and income statement has been intermediated by large organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And what they haven't really thought about is, okay, if I could re-engineer my time and do a lot more for myself, or use my money, my famous story is I had one person who kept complaining that the yields on their portfolio were going down and their water bill was going up. And I said, this is very simple. Sell your stock and build a well. And but there are all sorts of opportunities to disintermediate throughout their balance sheet and income statement. But it requires, understanding what tools like yours can do. And, why don't I just do that myself? Or why don't why doesn't the family get together and learn how to do this ourselves?
What are some examples? Like, okay, so the build a well. I mean, what kind of? So, can you tell us a little bit? I mean, that's an
sure.
Interesting
so,
story.
So another example is I have, I pay somebody pays a utility bill for their energy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but it also exposes them to an increase in inflation. So if you look at the economics of providing my energy myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it could be providing my primary source of energy. It could be providing my backup source of energy. What you discover is, you know, maybe it's economic to do it myself, maybe it isn't. But if I do it myself, it will protect me from further increases. You know, if suddenly the cost of energy should skyrocket,
right.
I'm protected. Right. And yeah. In fact, a lot of what whipsaws family is you get these cycles of sudden, you know, sudden price changes, and they get whipsawed. And part of making them strong is to protect them from those whipsaws.
I kind of look at it very simply as we're in control of our own destiny here. It's like being off-grid or doing things yourself means that you're just not susceptible to all these uncontrollable market forces. Yeah.
Well, if you look at what somebody has to do to generate an income, mm-hmm. there are tremendous expenses involved in generating income. You know, I have to get my clothes dry cleaned. I have to buy, you know, more and different kinds of clothes. I have to commute to the office. I have to pay taxes. There may be professional taxes and fees involved. And so for me to get a dollar to pay my energy, I have to make $2 or $3. And then
right.
suddenly you say, well, wait a minute. You know, how much time does it take me to make that $3? And if I do it myself, you know, maybe I get a lot less revenues, but if you look at my wealth in terms of my financial or living equity, in fact, what I can show your models where, yes, your revenue goes down, but your savings in terms of things that create equity go up. Okay,
yeah.
And it can be pure financial equity because, in fact, you know, I have less revenues, but I'm building the assets within my home base that
right.
make this whole operation require much less cash flow.
Right, especially if those assets are generative, where they
right.
generate more value over time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's the nature
right.
of the Global Village Construction Set. It's a constructor. It's not a static thing. You can make
right.
more of these things with it.
Right. So one thing I've always wanted to, and I've worked occasionally with the permaculturalists on, is if you look at a family budget and how much money they spend on landscaping.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realize, well, wait a minute, why don't you convert that landscape into an edible landscape?
Mm-hmm.
And so the economics of that, both in terms of your food budget, but also your health budget, are much better over long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
to me, you know, part of it is it's 1,000 little things. That's why I sort of love the permacultural approach. Because it's 1,000 little things of, you know, putting your herb garden next to the kitchen instead of far away. And,
right.
you know, little things that save, you know, something that saves 10 minutes a week. If you come up with 100 of those over 30 years, it makes a difference.
It does. And I think the main challenge for a lot of people is dealing with the complexity involved. And that's where we have to,
right.
I guess, be open to that. I mean, to
right.
be the integrative thinkers. Yeah.
Right. So not everybody's a brilliant physicist. So that's why we appreciate your help. Okay, so just describe the term open source ecology. I think it's very valuable to understand this notion of an open
right.
source ecology and how you came up with a name and what it means and why it's important to everything.
Right. So I will first refer you to the wiki regarding the definition as we phrased it in about 2004. In a legacy site for OSE, but I talked about open source ecology being a system that integrates human and natural parts in complete harmony along the lines of open source or open collaboration or just flow, like flow happens in nature. So ecology refers to the integration
uh-huh.
of many things, and open source, I mean, that's kind of the best name I could come up for what I was thinking. It includes an open source economy, open source institution in harmony with how natural resources are extracted, because the sunlight, rocks, soil, plants, water, that's where all the wealth of the economy comes from, right? So we have to integrate that with the human experience.
Right. So the way I would say it, to me, what you're doing is, or what open source ecology is about, is a a sort of a process and methodology to optimize living equity. And, okay. You know, so that's how Financial Weenie might say it.
Okay. I'll start using that to my financial pals.
Okay. So before we close, let's just walk. There was one question I had to ask you because I've been fascinated by it. You mentioned weeds, and the thing that I have found is the real killer in terms of making growing fresh food economic is the weeds.
So, weeds, yeah.
There's one group out in California that's been working on building sort of little robotics tools that can identify and weed without a human having to do it, and I was sort of wondering what you're doing in the weed area and what think of that.
It depends what scale you are. Broad-scale agriculture, you have cultivation. I mean, that's one way to go. Or you can go with beds. Like, say you get, like, semi-field scale beds that are just one technique I heard about, and I've never done it, but is, like, you have wide rows that you mow in between, and you put all the clippings into the growing beds. So basically it's constantly mulched. But the other thing is, yeah, I mean, the robotics thing, so our tractor plus Arduino and automated controls yields GPS precision automated farming, but we don't need to go there. There's simple tools available right now, like, for example, AgroCrew. I don't know if you've, maybe some people in the audience have heard about it, but it's basically a pivot system where there's a tiller weeder that goes around on a pivot. The thing pivots and can manage a, say, like a 30-foot radius or 50-foot radius pivot, where essentially automatically you can have this thing in your backyard, hit the return button when you program it, and you've got weeding, tilling, you can have planting done automatically. So that to me is actually, I mean, sounds a little bit, you know, we're getting away from nature here, but, you know, nobody, I mean, this could be something that the person who has no time for it can actually get absolutely immersed in their agricultural system.
Wow.
I see a lot of potential.
Right. I think there is a lot of potential. You know, for many years I was persuaded that the federal government did everything it could do to kind of hire up the smart guys so they couldn't go off and figure all this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but as the deficits compound, that's changing. And that gives me a lot of hope. Okay, well,
that the system cannot suck up all the smart guys?
Right.
Well, there's too many rebels out there. That's never going to happen. And there's Joy's Law. Whoever you are, all the talent is outside of your organization.
Okay, so before we close, let's walk us through again. I want to make sure everybody in the audience knows how they can connect, learn about, plug in, or if they want to participate, the different ways of doing so.
Okay, so first of all, I'd like to open up my emails. Email me, people, Marcin, M-A-R-C-I-N, at opensourceecology.org. If you've got any questions regarding signing up as a true fan, joining on-site for a dedicated project visit, that could be university internships, community service, a project that you can do on-site here. There's the design sprint. So one thing we're really trying to get up in numbers is the design sprint. You can look that up on a wiki under design sprint. But we're trying to get those numbers up to get the radically efficient development cycles where we can design a complex machine in as little as a single day. And that's a goal. That's one of the goals for within the next 6 months. We'll see if we can organize that. As far as getting in touch, just finding out about us, the best place to follow the continuous progress is the blog.
Okay.
So it would be blog.opensourceecology.org. And our main static site is simply opensourceecology.org, where there's links to the wiki, to the blog, and everything else. But if you talk about points of entry, I mean, true fans for donations, but basically where people sign up for a $10 per month donation for the next 24 months, the dedicated project visits on site, and the design sprints held every single Saturday. I'm committing to that. I find a lot of good energy comes from that. Design sprints on Saturdays from 9 to 5 Central Standard Time.
Okay. 9 to 5 Central? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Marcin, thank you so much for joining us on the Solera Report. And if you feel like it, hold on, and I'll give you a 10-minute overview of the MIT Project Management System.
Absolutely. That would be great. Thank you so much, Catherine. This is great. I love to be in further contact and scheme on some of these things.
We're in cahoots. We're in cahoots.
Mm-hmm.